Any other time, his fabled power with the animals would have beguiled the dog into docility. However, the big black hell dog was aggravated. Edward had rudely come between him and a meal. The dog came at them in a fury and jumped. Holding the girl in one arm, Bloom reached out with the other and grabbed the dog by his neck, then slammed him to the ground. The dog yelped, but got back on all fours and growled with a frightful seriousness. His head swung from side to side with a dizzying speed. For a moment he looked as if he had two heads, growling and baring two sets of teeth and pink-white gums. By this time the Morgans had noticed their little girl was missing and had come running in the direction of the dog's terrible howl. They arrived in time to see the dog lunge once more, this time barely missing my father's neck, his warm, moist breath spraying past. This was the dog's fatal mistake. Leaving his bare underside exposed as he jumped so high into the air, Edward Bloom was able to thrust his hand through the dog's hair and skin and into the body proper, clutching and finally ripping out his massive beating heart. My father held the girl so close, nestled into his wide shoulder, that she was spared this last gory scene. As the dog fell heavy to the ground, my father dropped the heart there also and handed the girl to her parents, and continued his walk into the night. Thus ended the three labors of Edward Bloom. He goes to war. He wasn't a general or a captain or an officer of any kind. He wasn't the medic, he wasn't the poet, he wasn't the cynic, he wasn't the lover, and he wasn't the radio operator. He was, of course, a sailor. Across the foamy sea, he rolled with hundreds of others aboard an invulnerable vessel called the Nereid. This was a ship as big as his hometown, bigger even. Certainly there were more people aboard the Nereid than living within the city limits of Ashland, though he had put a great distance between himself and that town. Since leaving, he had accomplished many great things, and now he was accomplishing the greatest of all, defending the free world. He felt in an odd way that the world rested on his shoulders, that even though he was merely a sailor without even a medal, without decoration of any kind, somehow the entire effort hinged on his ability to see it through. It was good to be a part of this crew then, on this invulnerable ship, slipping through the wine-dark sea, being surrounded by water, by horizons everywhere he looked, made him consider the greater world lying beyond, and the possibility that the world held out to him. Being surrounded by water made him feel secure and at peace. This is how he was feeling when a torpedo ripped into the hull. The ship felt like it had run aground, and Edward was thrown 4 feet across the deck. The ship began to list. "All hands on deck," the loudspeaker boomed. "Blow up your life belts." My father, a part of him in shock, thinking, "This isn't supposed to happen," found his life belt and tied one of the cords around his neck and the other around his waist. He looked around him, annoyed. "This isn't supposed to happen," but far from panic. No one around him panicked either. Everyone was amazingly cool, as if this were a drill, but the Nereid was listing to port. The captain's voice came then on the loudspeaker. "All hands on deck. Prepare to abandon ship." Still there was no alarm, no hurry. Those on the flag deck moved toward a companionway leading to the quarter deck. There was no pushing. Edward smiled at his friends, and they smiled back, even though the ship they were on was going down. On deck he saw the extent of his new reality. Men were tossing rafts overboard, as well as pieces of wood, life belts, benches, anything that would float. Then they jumped into the sea after them. But the ship was like a series of ledges. Many misjudged the distance, hit the side of the ship, and slid into the sea. Everywhere, men were flinging themselves into the water. Hundreds of heads, like human buoys, were bobbing in the water. The propeller was still turning, and some of the men were sucked into its turning blades. Edward sat down on the edge of the ship and removed the last letter he had received from his wife. "Not a day goes by that I don't think of you. I even pray just started. Feels good. Hope it helps some. He smiled, refolded the letter, and placed it back in his pocket. He took off his shoes and his socks, and he rolled each sock up in a ball and placed them in the toes of his shoes. He watched as a man near him jumped off the ship and onto another man, and both disappeared. I don't want to jump on anybody, he thought, and looked for an open spot. But down below, the sea was covered in a sheet of oil, and he didn't want to jump into that either. So he looked until he found a clear circle of water, a place the oil had yet to saturate, and he pretended to believe he could jump from the side of the ship straight into it. Miraculously, he did. He jumped the 20 feet from the side of the ship directly into that spot of sea, where he sank fast and didn't rise. He remained suspended 30, maybe even 40 feet below the surface, like a fly in amber. He could see the ship sinking to one side, and above him, hundreds and hundreds of legs of his fellow sailors, like a great giant centipede swimming in the sea. He felt as though he should be drowning by then, but he wasn't. In fact, he seemed to be breathing, not through his mouth, but through his own body. He didn't understand it, but he was breathing, and he thought this meant he was dead. But then, in the distance away from the ship, he saw a young girl waving to him. The same girl he remembered from a long time ago. He knew that in a minute. She was waving him toward her, smiling, as though she'd been waiting on him there for some time. He began to swim toward her. Same girl, all right, a little older now, as he was, but the same girl. As he got closer, she swam out farther and kept waving. He didn't know how long he was underwater like that, swimming toward her, but it was longer than it should have been. He swam until a shaft of sunlight broke through the oil-shrouded sea, and he looked up to see there was no oil there, just pure blue. And then he looked for the girl. Young lady, he corrected himself. But she was gone, too. And all of a sudden, he was in need of a breath of fresh air. So he moved toward the surface sunlight, suddenly as light and fast as a bubble himself. And when he popped into the bright world, saw how far away he was from everyone. They were treading water, moving slowly through the oil, but they saw Edward waving to them as the girl had waved to him, and it gave them a sense of purpose, even hope. And those who saw him began to swim toward my father as fast as they possibly could. Hundreds of men moved sluggishly through the oil toward him. Some didn't, though. Even some who saw him didn't move. And these were the men who were sucked back under when the Nereid finally went down. Even as far out as Edward was, he felt the futile tug of the ship on his body, pulling him back. But he wasn't going back. He was going home. My Father's Death, Take 3. It happens like this. Old Dr. Bennett, our family doctor, comes out of the guest room and gently shuts the door behind him. Older than old, Dr. Bennett has been part of our lives forever. He was even there when I was born, at which time he had been asked by the local medical board to please retire soon. That's how old he is. Dr. Bennett is now too old for almost anything. He doesn't walk so much as shuffle, doesn't breathe so much as gasp, and he seems unable to deal with the consequences of his patient's terminal condition. As he comes out of the guest room where my father's been staying for the last few weeks, Dr. Bennett breaks down in a storm of tears, and for some time can't speak, he's crying so much, shoulders heaving, his crumpled old hands cupped over his eyes. Finally, he's able to look up and gasp for breath. He looks like a lost child, and he says to my mother and me, we who are now prepared for the very worst,
I don't really know what's going on. I can't tell anymore. He seems pretty bad off, though. Best go see for yourself.
My mother looks at me, and it's that look of final resignation I see in her eyes. That look that says she's ready for whatever awaits her beyond the door, however sad or horrible. She is ready. She takes my hand and holds it tight before standing and going in. Dr. Bennett falls into my father's chair and slumps there as if emptied of the will to go on. For a moment, I think he's dead. For a moment, I think death has come and passed my father over and decided to take this one instead. But no, death has come for my father. Dr. Bennett opens his eyes and stares into the wild, distant, empty space before him. And I can guess what he's thinking. Edward Bloom, who would have thought? Man of the world, importer-exporter, we all thought you'd live forever, though the rest of us fall like leaves from a tree. If there was one to withstand the harsh winter ahead and hang on for dear life, we thought it would be you. As though he were a god, this is how we've come to think of my father. Although we have seen him early in the morning in his boxer shorts and late at night asleep in front of the television after everything on it has gone off the air, mouth open, blue light like a shroud over his dreaming face, we believe he is somehow divine, a god of laughter, the god who can't speak but to say, there was this man, or perhaps part god. The product of a mortal woman and some glorious entity descended here to make the world the kind of place where more people laughed and, inspired by their laughter, bought things from my father to make their lives better and his life better. And in that way, all lives were made better. He's funny, and he makes money, and what could be better than that? He even laughs at death. He laughs at my tears. I hear him laughing now as my mother leaves the room, shaking her head. Incorrigible, she says. Completely and totally incorrigible. She's crying, too. But these are not tears of grief or sadness. Those tears have already been shed. These are tears of frustration, of being alive and alone while my father lies in the guest room dying and not dying right. I look at her, and with my eyes asked, should I? And she shrugs her shoulders as if to say, it's up to you. Go in if you'd like. And seems to be on the verge of a kind of laughter herself, if she weren't already crying, which is a confusing sort of expression for a face to have to bear. Dr. Bennett seems to have fallen asleep in my father's chair. I stand and go to the half-closed door and peer beyond it. My father is sitting up, braced by a load of pillows, still and staring at nothing as though he were on pause, waiting for someone or something to activate him, which is what my presence does. When he sees me, he smiles.
Come in, William, he says.
Well, you seem to be feeling better, I say, sitting down in the chair beside his bed, the chair I've been sitting in every day for the last few weeks. In my father's journey to the end of his life, this chair is the place I watch from.
I am feeling better,
he says, nodding, taking a deep breath as if to prove it.
I think I am.
But only today, for this moment on this day. There's no turning back now for my father. To get better now would take more than a miracle. It would take a written excuse from Zeus himself, signed in triplicate and sent to every other deity who might lay claim to my father's withered body and soul. He's already a little bit dead, I think, if such a thing were possible. The metamorphosis that has occurred would be too much to believe if I hadn't seen it myself. At first, small lesions appeared on his arms and legs. They were treated, but to no real effect. Then they appeared to heal on their own, eventually. Not, however, in a way we might have hoped for or expected. Instead of his soft white skin with the long black hairs growing out of it like corn silk, his skin has become hard and shiny, indeed, almost scaly, like a second skin. Looking at him isn't hard until you leave the room and see the photo sitting on the fireplace mantel. It was taken 6 or 7 years ago on a beach in California, and when you look at it, you can see a man. He's not a man in the same way now. He's something else altogether.
Not good, really, he says, revising himself. I wouldn't say good, but better.
I just wondered what bothered Dr. Bennett, I say. He seemed really concerned when he came out of here. My father nods.
Honestly, he says in a confidential tone, I think it was my jokes.
Your jokes?
My doctor jokes. I think he'd heard one too many.
And my father begins to recite his litany of tired old jokes.
Doctor, doctor, I've only got 59 seconds to live. Hang on, I'll be with you in a minute. Doctor, doctor, I keep thinking I'm a pair of curtains. Come on, pull yourself together. Doctor, doctor, my sister thinks she's in a lift. Tell her to come in. I can't. She doesn't stop at this floor. Doctor, doctor, I feel like a goat. Stop acting like a little kid. Doctor, doctor, I think I'm shrinking. You'll just have to be a little patient. I know a million of them, he says proudly.
I bet you do.
I give him a couple every time he comes in here, but I guess he heard one too many. I don't think he has a very good sense of humor anyway, he says. Most doctors don't.
Or maybe he just wanted you to be straight with him, I say.
Straight?
Straightforward, I say. Just be your normal, average guy and tell him what's bothering you, where it hurts.
Ah, my father says. As in, doctor, doctor, I'm dying, please cure me. Like that?
Like that, I say.
Sort of, but... But we both know there's no cure for what I've got, he says,
the smile diminishing, his body falling deeper into the bed, the old fragility returning.
Reminds me of the Great Plague of 33. No one knew what it was or where it came from. One day everything seemed fine, and the next, the strongest man in Ashland, dead, died while eating his breakfast. Rigor mortis set in so quick his body froze right there at the kitchen table, spoon lifted halfway to his mouth. After him, a dozen died in an hour. Somehow, I was immune. I watched my neighbors fall to the ground as though their bodies had become suddenly vacant. As if...
Dad, I say a couple of times, and when he finally stops, I take his thin and brittle hand in my own. No more stories, okay? No more stupid jokes.
They're stupid.
I mean that in the nicest possible way.
Thank you.
Just for a little while, I say. Let's talk, okay? Man to man, father to son. No more stories.
Stories? You think I tell stories? You wouldn't believe the stories my dad used to tell me. You think I'd tell you stories? When I was a boy, I heard stories. He'd wake me up in the middle of the night to tell me a story. It was awful.
But even that's a story, Dad. I don't believe it for a minute.
You're not necessarily supposed to believe it, he says wearily. You're just supposed to believe in it. It's like a metaphor.
I forget, I say. What's a metaphor?
Cows and sheep, mostly,
he says, wincing a bit as he says it. See? I say. Even when you're serious, you can't keep from joking. It's frustrating, Dad. It keeps me at arm's length. It's like you're scared of me or something.
Scared of you? He says, rolling his eyes. I'm dying and I'm supposed to be scared of you?
Scared of getting close to me. He takes this in, my old man, and looks away into his past.
It must have something to do with my father, he says.